Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm Mona, and I was married for 30 years, and we didn't know we were a neurodiverse couple until our 29th year of marriage. And we were together for 32 years, and I've been divorced since 2018. And together, we have an amazing adult daughter who is thriving and doing fantastic. And I am really excited about the conversation on today's podcast because I have Lita Farr, who is not only a coach and a therapist, but she also does something called premarital counseling that I think is really important. And I think it could be it's counseling and coaching. And I think it could be so helpful to those folks that are in a new relationship or trying to transform their current relationships. She's also a sex therapist. So Lita, welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm so glad you're here.
Mona, thank you so much for having me. It's wonderful to be able to join you today.
Yeah, we're going to have a great conversation. So Lita, I'd love if you'd share a little bit about kind of what got you into the work that you're doing and maybe some of your special training, because I know that you have a diverse array of expertise. And also, I think you said you're licensed in 7 states, which I know is rare. And so there'll probably be a lot of folks that want to reach out to you.
Yeah, certainly. So I am a licensed professional counselor, and I'm a relationship and sex therapist. I am licensed in Washington, D.C., Maryland, Virginia, Chicago, Illinois, which is where I'm from, actually, and New York and New Jersey. And I am a telehealth provider into Florida. So I cover many states as far as being on the therapy end of my practice.
Wonderful. And what got you into therapy and coaching and even working a little bit with, you know, neurodiverse couples and neurodivergent individuals?
Yeah. So I've been a therapist for about maybe 17, 18 years and working with on relationship issues and sex therapy. I have noticed over maybe the past 7, 8 years how I have been getting more and more clients, both individual and couples, that identify as being neurodivergent. And it's just fascinating to me. I love working with this group of folks. And so I decided to learn more about it and, if you will, become more specialized. So I sought training through the AANE, which is the Association for Autism and Neurodiversity. I am also a level 2 Gottman trained therapist, and I incorporate the Gottman relationship assessment into a lot of my work with couples, which kind of provides like an x-ray vision of what's taking place in their relationship. And in addition to that, I'm also a ASECT sex therapist. ASECT is the highest level of training for sex therapists. And with that, I also work with a lot of neurodivergent individuals and couples.
I love it. I love the diversity of your training. And I think you're actually probably the first therapist and coach that has come on the podcast that has the level of diversity in your training and experience. So I think this conversation is going to be so helpful to all of the listeners, because we're going to talk about something that I wish I had, Lita, and that was, you know, premarital counseling or coaching. And I think, you know, many of the folks that are struggling that reach out to me, if they had known at the beginning of their marriage or relationship about the differences in how their brains functioned and their neurology, I think they could have avoided so much unintentional pain and hurt. And I know that was the case for me. If I had understood my ADHD brain and understood my ex-husband's probably autistic and ADHD brain and all the things that we didn't know about each other, if we had understood them, oh my gosh, we would have avoided so much unintentional hurt and pain and so many conflicts that we had. So I would love if you could share a little bit about kind of what would a couple that is interested in premarital counseling or coaching How would they start that? Is it, you know, one session? Is it multiple sessions? I would love you to just give us a little overview of that, and then we'll talk about some of the things that you address during that.
Yeah, absolutely. So it depends on how in-depth they want to go into is really the answer, is that it depends. I do offer a coaching package, which is just four sessions where I meet with a couple, and this is coaching. So this can kind of, you know, take place anywhere, because we're not getting into anxiety or any mental health type issues, depressions, anything like that. Right. So we're looking at what we do from today going forward. And within that package, I meet with a couple once just to kind of see where they're at, what they're interested in parsing out. And then I have them take the Gottman relationship assessment, which hits on many different areas that couples will undoubtedly run into, such as communication, intimacy, conflict resolution, overall relationship satisfaction, and friendship and trust, right? So like I say, it's the Gottman relationship assessment for me is like an x-ray vision of what's going on in this relationship. And each individual takes it on their own time, no pressure. And then we spend the last two sessions kind of reviewing the results of that. And sometimes the couples are surprised at what comes out of that. That's one service that I provide. And then the other service is on the therapeutic end, where we do something similar, but we also kind of get a lot into the past, what took place in this couple's past, what brings them to where they're at, what are some of the difficulties or challenges that they have encountered.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Again, I wish I had had that at the beginning of my marriage. And, you know, when we know better, we can do better. So if I were ever to get into another long-term relationship, I would probably be doing the Gottman relationship assessment with my partner for sure. I think that's really helpful. So let's talk a little bit about some of the challenges that the couples that you work with experience. And one of the things that I hear often is that people literally do not know what they want, right? And mm-hmm. I think that's such an important thing to have that self-awareness. So what are some of the challenges that you hear about repeatedly regarding things that people do not know they want, but by either taking the assessment and going to coaching or therapy with you or having conversations with you, they realize these are things they actually want and need, Lita, but don't know it. Any in particular that are like repeat patterns?
I think that one thing that comes out quite often between the couples that I work with is just different communication and social battery issues. Behavioral patterns that at the beginning of a relationship may seem okay, and then down the line, it may raise some question marks for one of the partners, right?
Yeah.
Or perhaps maybe some particular hobby that, again, at the beginning of a relationship, the one couple is fine with it, but then they find, my gosh, this is really taking up too much time. And most importantly, just differences in communication styles. It's really important, I do want to highlight this, that I don't see neurodivergence as a deficit. I don't view it in that manner at all. It's simply a different way of experiencing and interacting with the world. And that is what I bring into the session, because I believe that both partners, regardless of whether they are neurodivergent or not, we all have unique strengths and abilities that can be celebrated and valued. And it's that we want to highlight in the relationship, in the sessions with me, as well as what are areas that they feel that they need to, that needs to be tweaked or is challenging.
Yeah, I feel the same way that you do. I feel we all have differently wired brains, and where the challenges occur is when we don't understand ourselves first, and we don't understand our partner, and we don't create a safe space in our relationship. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about physical, I'm talking about emotional.
Absolutely.
A safe emotional space to be able to ask questions and to be curious and to really listen to understand. I mean, I know I was guilty of that too, you know, jumping in when my ex was saying something and judging him or getting too emotional. So I think the issues that you touched on, I think, are really, really important. And I'd like to delve a little bit into the communication piece, because I know that one of the areas where I hear the most challenges are is when one partner wants to communicate, to connect, and wants to share their emotions, you know, and may get very emotional. They may cry, they may raise their voice, they may talk faster, whatever. And the other partner may not want to communicate like that. So how can a couple who is having those communication differences, and it may also be related to emotional differences, how do you help them kind of connect in a more positive way?
Yeah, so I think the concept of that safe space that you just highlighted is what I bring. Because believe it or not, many couples do not really have that safe space, judgment-free zone available to them, where they can really sit there and talk about what is going on with them. What are they experiencing in the relationship? What's working for them and what isn't? In essence, having these sessions prior to getting married will save couples a lot of issues after marriage. Yes. You know, it's more like definitely a proactive approach, if you will, right? Rather than reactive,
right.
Which is what I'm all about. So that's what I do with the couples. And it is, you know, therapy with me is quite light, and I try to, you know, throw in a lot of humor in there. I think it's just very important to have that safe space to talk about what's going on, what's bothering the one partner or both partners. Having those uncomfortable conversations that you normally would not have, and making the time and space to address those.
I think that's so important. And I know a lot of folks, I run two support groups for neurotypicals and just started a support group for mixed neurotype folks with a colleague of mine. And I know sometimes people share that they're afraid to speak up. And, you know, I hear that often. They're afraid to ask questions. They're afraid of what the response will be. And I'm wondering if there are any tools or techniques or strategies that you advise your couples that you're working with to help them learn how to create that safe space so they can speak up and ask questions and share their wants and needs. Is there anything in particular that they can do without, you know, coming to a counselor or a therapist?
Certainly, I think it's very important to track your thoughts and feelings, right? So if I am consistently feeling a certain way day after day, having that written down is a reminder that that is something that needs to be addressed, regardless of whether the individual is seeking a therapist or a coach.
Right? Yeah.
One of the main things that I really stress with all my individuals and couples is really aiming towards working towards being our authentic self.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of loaded, right? Because how many of us are truly authentic?
Yeah.
In particular, in our relationships.
Right. Yeah. Not a lot. Probably are fully authentic because we're afraid, right?
Exactly.
Fear stops us from being our authentic selves, of whether we feel we won't be accepted or we're not going to be worthy enough or whatever. Yeah.
And I don't mean this only in romantic relationship. This could be in relationships with friends, with colleagues, family members, etc. So it's really knowing what is it that we want? What are we striving for? And what is it that we're having challenges with?
Yeah, and being able to document that. I love that. I think the self-awareness is so critical. And I hear from a lot of folks, and I know I did this often in my marriage, is I would get emotionally dysregulated and didn't know how to calm myself down without having to have my ex-husband work with me on resolving whatever the issue was that got me dysregulated. And I know over time I've learned how to re-regulate myself. But, you know, when you grow up in a home where you don't learn that, and then you get into a relationship with somebody that neither one of you have learned that. It's really, really hard if you don't find a therapist or a coach who can help you learn how to become more self-aware and then to figure out how to regulate your emotions when you're dysregulated. Because the worst thing to do, Lita, right, is to talk or fight when you're both dysregulated.
Absolutely, because then both parties feel that they're being dismissed and not acknowledged. And that's a key. And that's what working with a therapist will hopefully do for the couple, is make them feel that they are being acknowledged and understood, right, instead of being dismissed. Because if we feel that we're being dismissed, that is really going to disturb us. And that will come out in different ways in how we interact with our partner.
All right. I think another issue that's really important is when couples really understand each other's roles in the relationship. I think sometimes we come into relationships either with a script, you know, based on the movies we've seen, or, you know, the TV shows we watch, or what we saw with our parents or our grandparents. And how do you help couples kind of get to a point where they are clear about their roles and they understand what they each want to do in the relationship and feel comfortable doing in the relationship?
Yeah, well, not everyone is 100% clear on the role that they want to have, but most are clear on what they don't want to have. And yes, that is often as a result of our family of origin. So for example, let's say if, you know, someone was raised in a family where there was a lot of yelling or being dismissed or issues being brushed under the rug, you know, these types of things taking place, obviously more often than not, that individual will grow up saying, this is not what I want repeated in the relationship, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, when I grow up or whatever, when I have a solid relationship, I don't want this. And those are the issues that we bring out. And once I start talking to the couples about that, then that really kind of helps them define their role more, you know? So for example, what would happen? This is a very common scenario where, you know, someone grew up in a family where issues were simply just not addressed. This is very common. This happens more frequently than you would think, right? And then the other individual was raised in a situation where things were addressed. Okay, well, how are we going to merge those two? Because despite the fact that the other party who did not grow up in that setting claims that he or she wants to address everything, maybe that they don't quite know how to communicate their needs.
Yeah, and how do you help them bridge that? Because that is, or was, the story of my marriage. I grew up with two psychologists, Lita.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah. If my father wasn't sitting me down to talk about issues that I was having, you know, I was going to my mother. My father kept his psychologist hat on even when he was in the father role. My mother was more of a friend mother, kind of not so much in the psychologist role when I would ask for questions. But how do you help couples bridge that? Because if they're coming to you for premarital counseling or coaching, or they're in the beginning of a relationship and they want to understand each other better, are there specific things that you suggest that they do?
Yeah. So I definitely, again, I provide a space where I encourage each partner to fully express their thoughts and feelings and what they need, and to be very direct about that. Okay. Because I think that this can help avoid any type of, you know, misunderstandings that could come up and promote effective communication. If we're unable to communicate what we need, then we will continue to run into issues.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the things that I learned way too late in my marriage was that, you know, speaking about a lot of different subjects at the same time was overwhelming to my ex.
Absolutely. Yep.
You want to address that?
Yeah. So what I do is, you know, I say to them, for example, what are the top two communication issues, or what are the top two things that you would like to express that you feel haven't been expressed as much as you want, or maybe you've had trouble expressing this, right? Mm-hmm. The other thing is having the other partner being able to actually listen to what that one partner is saying. So again, you know, in therapy sessions, the other party cannot feel that they are being dismissed or not acknowledged, right? So that's the beauty of therapy or coaching. where that bridge is being gapped there.
Yeah. And I know that that happened often in my marriage where I'd interrupt my ex-husband. He often would shut down and just listen in that deer in headlights look, but I would interrupt. I would judge. I was critical. I would scream. I would get very emotional. And I know that can be really, really overwhelming. So to have kind of the intermediary as a coach or a therapist to help, and also with the translation, you know, to help kind of bridge that gap and help both partners understand that there's a better way to communicate with each other that's less emotional maybe, and not so overwhelming for one or both partners.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so, you know, that my goal is to help them, to teach the couple to create a safe and supportive environment for open communication, so that even when they're not having sessions with me, right, that they would be able to continue conversations with themselves. And part of that is helping them have empathy and understanding between the partners, so that they can recognize and validate each other's experiences and emotions and challenges.
Yeah. And there's different tools and strategies to do that. I don't know if you want to talk about any in particular, but if you do, I'd love to hear that.
There's so many.
Maybe one that I know, I statements, people talk about I statements and, you know, I feel this way, or I would like this, or
I think, you know, I statements are pretty fundamental and can definitely be used. I think another thing that I really try to incorporate is making sure, like, having the other individual that's listening see how they would feel in that particular situation. How is their level of empathy and understanding with respect to what their partner is explaining, you know? And if it is something that they just can't really resonate with, is there any compromise or flexibility with them, right?
Yeah.
So that they're not always walking away saying, I'm right, or he or she is wrong. And again, this is part of fostering open communication and having flexibility when trying to resolve conflicts or even making decisions. To try to find common ground.
Yeah, that's so important. And to see that you're a team and you're working together to solve the problem, you're not against each other. You're not each other's enemies.
Absolutely. Right? So we're starting off with the notion that we're friends, right? Because when we're friends, we're not really necessarily competing with each other. We're on the same team. And that's how we want to stay. We want to support each other. We want to be part of the same team.
Yeah. That's so important. I know it's critical. And, you know, being part of the same team, you know, you want to be able to do fun things together. And I hear over and over again about how in neurodiverse relationships, one partner may want to socialize more, you know, may want to go out more, may want to be engaged in more family events. And I know if you're doing premarital counseling and, you know, the couple is planning on getting married, there are so many different things involved in a wedding, right? So I'd love to talk a little bit about the maybe social battery or social differences in the actual planning of the wedding and the actual wedding day. And then maybe, you know, after you're married and you're together, how to kind of resolve maybe the challenges you might have if you don't have this conversation ahead of time. Let's talk about planning a wedding.
Planning a wedding, right? That's what a lot of couples come to me with. And it's just fascinating because I find that weddings bring out so many emotions, not only in the couple, but within their families and expectations that all of a sudden come out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And the couple is left juggling on, you know, who do I make happy? What should I do here? And of course, budgets and so many other variables that come in to play. This concept of the social battery, we'll see that now as we near the holidays, by the way, as well. So it's not just weddings, it's overall life in general, right? Where there's like an anticipation that we have to participate in events in a certain way or in a certain capacity that is potentially beyond our comfort zone.
Right. Right. And so when you're planning a wedding, there's the idea of the venue, right?
Yes.
The menu, like what are the foods,
right?
The guest list.
The guest list is a huge problem.
Okay, let's talk about that.
Not only the guest list, but the seating arrangement, you know, yes, that couples come to me with. Well, first of all, you know, with weddings, usually what happens is one partner may want, let's say, to have 20 or 30 people, a much smaller wedding, right? And the other one may want to have much more. So that, just starting to think about that, could provide a lot of, cause a lot of sensory overload for one partner, right? Causing them to just kind of like, if you will, check out right then and there with respect to the wedding planning process. So you could see right there how that would cause a lot of misunderstanding for the other partner. You know, the other partner may feel like, well, maybe he or she doesn't even want to get married to me, right? But that's really not what's going on here, right? And so that's where we need to communicate again as to what is really each individual's limit. And people, again, don't communicate about this. They think about the actual wedding instead of what this will do to their relationship and what are they going to take away from this.
Yeah. And this could be literally one of the best days of your life or one of the worst days.
Exactly. And, you know, this can spiral into so many different things after the wedding or even during the wedding. And that's where, you know, the therapy for the wedding, I really, really help couples parse out what is important to them. What is it that they want just between them, the individuals that are getting married, not between family members, okay? Because that brings in a whole other subset of complications. What is it that they want for their day to celebrate their union, okay? And then we can begin to work on the rest.
Yeah. And so the venue, you know, if there is going to be loud music the entire time, that might not work for, you know, the neurodivergent partner, the autistic partner. They may need time alone.
They may need breaks along the way. Absolutely. So, you know, many times, like scheduling, for example, the ceremony and the reception after another is really not a good idea. And then there's also photography along the way. Just it's time, like events right after another during the wedding ceremony where the person needs to be present, right? Mm-hmm. So we definitely need to plan for intentional breaks.
I love that.
Intentional breaks. And that is regardless of whether you're neurodiverse or not, to kind of reset. Okay. We need to work on having cues with each other. So that, let's say if during the reception, you know, if one partner needs to step out, for example, okay, that you can give that cue to the partner so that he or she will not be offended if they just need to step out for whatever, even for 5 minutes, let's say to just get some fresh air.
Right. Okay.
This is all part of being on the same page, is to putting it out there to see what is it that each member needs. Okay. The nuances of how they work. And what makes them feel comfortable. Feeling comfortable is very important, because if we don't feel comfortable in a setting, even if it's our wedding day, we are going to get activated. And if we're activated, we will begin to, that will show up in different ways.
Yeah. And showing up in different ways may mean drinking too much, right? And then
absolutely drinking too much, not socializing in the way that is expected of us or wanted of us to socialize.
Right.
Possibly that again could lead into a lot of different problems, not spending enough time, let's say, with the right folks.
Right. Right. And, you know, one or both partners feeling very disconnected because they didn't have these conversations ahead of time, or they just recently found out that they're a neurodiverse couple, or they're not thinking that they have different needs. And so they have moved forward with the planning, and then the day turns into something different than
completely
they thought.
Completely different. Absolutely. Yeah. So these are things that people usually don't account for when planning for a wedding. You know, usually people get engaged and then they leap, you know, onto the next step without thinking about all these different nuances and needs that people have.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that happened with my wedding. I mean, it was a long time ago, 1987, I got married. So I don't remember a lot of the details, Lita, but I do remember my ex really stepping back and letting me take control of everything. I would ask him questions and he really didn't care, you know, what we had. I think he had one food item he wanted. We had a buffet and that was it. Other than that, he let me make all the plans and do everything. And I think I really wanted him to be more involved, but he didn't want to be. And it wasn't because he didn't want to be married, that he wasn't excited, he wasn't looking forward to it. Either I was too overwhelming, or the process was too overwhelming, or he really trusted that I would make the best decisions for both of us. Or maybe it was a little bit of all three of those things. I don't think I'll ever know. But you could feel like your partner isn't as committed as you are if they take a step back. And the reason they're taking a step back, maybe for their own emotional balance and regulation.
Absolutely. Right. They may just not have the bandwidth for that particular event. Right. But that could be misconstrued by the other party. Kind of like what you just said is, well, maybe they're not interested. Maybe they don't even want a wedding. Maybe this, maybe that. Right. And all that could just spiral into a lot of different things.
Right. And the stories we tell ourselves can create a narrative in our heads that can be really, really challenging. And again, can cause conflict on a day that's supposed to be special. And I know the menu is a piece that probably a lot of neurodiverse couples don't think about, whether it's their wedding or another family event. You know, if your partner has sensory sensitivities regarding certain foods and you're not taking that into consideration and making sure that the foods they can eat, want to eat, feel safe eating are there, that could be a big challenge too.
Absolutely. So for example, if I go somewhere and I don't like the taste, texture, smell of whatever is being offered, I'm not going to eat it. But that could then be viewed as maybe I'm rude, I'm cold, you know, I'm insensitive to the amount of work the host put into preparing the meal, et cetera, et cetera. And again, that's something that can easily be discussed in sessions so that both partners can have clarity.
Right. And I think the guest list is another important issue because, you know, I think when you're in a wedding, or you are getting married, or you're going to a family event that has to do with the wedding, you know, because there's the family dinners and there may be, you know,
the expectations.
Right. So, you know, when you know you're a neurodivergent couple or a neurodiverse couple, I think it's a lot easier. But when you don't know you're a neurodiverse couple, but you know you have different needs, understanding that, you know, maybe one of you does not want to have a bachelorette party or maybe or a bachelor party, or you don't want to have that family dinner because then you're going to have to be on for 4 hours and talk all the time, right?
Right.
So having those conversations are really, really, it's going to be really, really important. And this conversation that we're having can also be applied to other family events and holidays, which we're coming upon. Is there anything else you want to say about that?
I just want to say that there are so many different ways of doing what we need to do in a non-traditional manner, you know, but we and our partner need to be clear on what it is that we need. I find that once both parties are clear or have an understanding, okay, or empathy towards what is needed and flexibility, then things usually turn out pretty much okay.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think these kind of conversations are so critical. And two things that I want to reiterate you said that I think the listeners can probably work on immediately. And this is for any social event, but definitely if they're thinking about getting married and they're in the planning stages, making sure they have those intentional breaks throughout all the events and they have that cue that they can share with each other. I suggest, you know, a code word or a particular tap, you know, a tap on the right shoulder,
exactly,
taking their right hand, whatever, and being very clear about what that means. Mm-hmm. And maybe one partner can't say the words in the moment because they're emotionally dysregulated or overwhelmed. So having that cue or that code or that touch can be really helpful.
Absolutely. Right? And in addition to that, I often recommend having like a safe person, basically a third person, let's say at a wedding, right? Maybe a best friend or someone that could like literally be tuned in and cued into you. So that person can be there to help you out. You know, when you're surrounded by crowds or in uncomfortable situations, where that person could also know the cue and could assist and maybe just purposely with intent interrupting something, you know what I mean? To pull one party away or maybe get them something that they need. There's a lot of different types of accommodations and things that can be done that are like out of the box that we can come up with.
Yes. I love having that third party because we had 100 people at our wedding and I think that's kind of a small wedding, you know, but, and if I had needed or my ex had needed somebody else to kind of guide us when we looked overwhelmed or seemed like we were confused or lost or whatever, it would have been really, really helpful. Yeah. I love that. And at family events too. I think that's really important. So I know we talked about this a little bit, but this is an area that I know creates conflict for a lot of folks. And that's when there are processing and thinking differences that one or both partners don't fully understand. And I was 100% guilty of this. I didn't know how long my ex needed to process things, you know, research his decisions or whatever. And I oftentimes had expectations of him that he could not meet. I could make a decision quickly in a matter of minutes, sometimes seconds, and it took him much longer. And it has nothing to do with intelligence. It has to do with that we had differently wired brains and I did not respect or honor or value his need for more processing time. So let's talk a little bit about what that would look like, you know, with the planning for a wedding or family events when one partner or both partners have different ways of processing and thinking about things.
Well, with respect to wedding planning, I think what's critical is to set aside, again, intentional time to discuss things. And when you're discussing different points, let's say for the wedding, we cannot expect anyone to cover everything, right? So maybe in that one sitting, like let's say the hour-long coffee chat that you guys have set aside for this, maybe just make it a point to discuss two items. So we don't want to have information overload is what I'm saying.
Yep.
Okay. Well, we have to be very cognizant of the fact of what you said, Mona, that we do process things differently. So, you know, someone that is neurodivergent may not be able to quickly snap back and respond in the manner that we may want. Okay. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Sometimes they think much more in depth and they may perceive or interpret something differently. And therefore they may need a little bit more time to respond. And we have to be able to allow time and space for that.
Yeah, I agree. I wish I had in my marriage and in every neurodiverse relationship that I've had since I have. And it just makes for, again, such an emotionally safe relationship. And I think that that's so critical for every relationship. But I think there are things that sometimes we have to do above and beyond in our neurodiverse relationships because we don't process things usually very, very much the same. We process things very differently and we have to. And I wish I could, you know, go back and change this. We have to be respectful of each other's processing and thinking or cognitive differences. Otherwise, it's going to create lots of challenges.
Right. We have to be very compassionate and flexible with one another.
Yes. Yes. And I know if we're not, Lita, that can cause so much anxiety, right?
Absolutely.
And
shutdown.
Yes. And that can look like your partner doesn't care. Mm-hmm. And I hear that often, that, you know, my partner doesn't care, they have no empathy. No, that's not what's going on. You're just processing things differently. You don't understand each other's, you know, emotional needs. You don't understand that one of you may be in dysregulation. And when your nervous system is dysregulated, all kinds of things can happen that aren't positive or pleasant.
Right. And that also, right away, it's very automatic for us to then change the narrative of what's going on.
Speak more to that.
You know,
what have you seen?
So if I have a partner that may, let's say, be overloaded or shutting down or not addressing things in the manner that we expect, in the time frame that we expect, we're going to start thinking a lot of different things. And, you know, in that person's mind, they're going to build a narrative like, is he or she checked out? Do they not care? Do I not matter? Am I not being recognized? Is what I'm saying not important? You get the gist. You can go on, and we can just spin things off into something that absolutely doesn't even exist.
Right.
And that was not the intention of the other individual.
Yep. Been there, done that, Lita.
Yep.
Way too many times. Yeah, that's so, so important. So that's, you know, something that we need to think about. And the last thing that I really want to talk about, because you are a sex therapist, is one of the issues that I hear repeatedly from neurodiverse couples where they have challenges. And in the beginning of the relationship, like when they were dating, it may have been very different. And that is their sex and physical intimacy, that part of their relationship. And then things start to change. It may be after the wedding. It may be after they move into one or the other's house or apartment. So I know, you know, we have that term hookup culture out there. Mm-hmm. People are doing that all the time. But I would love to talk a little bit about some of the challenges that you see couples having, neurodiverse couples having, when they're thinking about either moving in with each other or getting married, related to sex and physical intimacy. What are some of the biggest challenges? And then we'll talk a little bit about some of the ways they can address them.
Yeah. So, you know, I also work with a lot of single individuals, regardless of whether they're neurodivergent or not. And this hookup culture is literally a problem.
Yeah.
Because it is what is out there. It is kind of what is expected, but so many people do not like it. And it just does not resonate with many people. Right. And especially amongst like the college crowd or, you know, the single people, they feel like, especially on the younger side, they feel like that this is really the only way to meet people. And that if you don't hook up in a manner that's expected, then you're just going to be left on the sidelines, you know, if you will. There's so many different types of intimacy challenges that neurodivergent individuals encounter and find it very, very difficult to talk about. And they become very, very self-aware of it, therefore causing more anxiety, performance-related issues, sensory-related issues, all play into this. I don't know if you have any specific suggestions or, yeah. or I'm sorry, any yeah. specific questions.
I do. Okay. So first, the hookup culture, maybe to define it. I mean, I know as an almost 60-year-old woman, it's, you know, and I'm dating. It's so interesting how quickly people want to have sex.
Yeah. And, immediately, right? Almost. And many yeah. just put it out there. Like, this is it. We're going to meet up for coffee and this is what's expected.
Yeah. And so whether you are neurodivergent or not, I think that that can be a challenge, right? Because, you know, you don't want to look like you're not cool or, you know, you're not into the person, but having sex on every first date is not necessarily the way to go. But that is the hookup culture, right?
Absolutely. So, absolutely.
Yeah. Do you want to talk? Did you want to say something else about that?
Yeah, no, I mean, just in line with what you were saying, you know, there's an expectation that, you know, I mean, kind of sex appears to have lost its meaning, you know, mm-hmm. it seems more often than not with the hookup culture, it's a given, you know, we're going to meet up and we're going to hook up. And what happens right. afterwards, who knows, maybe we'll hook up again or we won't. And, you know, in particular, you know, when folks go out, like maybe with a group, like, you know, two or three people or whatever, you know, I often work with clients that say, yeah, but you know, I was in this group and all of them, they decided to hook up, but I didn't. And, you know, now I feel left out. I was standing around with nothing to do. And I don't want to go out with these people again, which constitutes the majority of their friends, because I'm not into this hookup culture.
Mm-hmm. And if you're the neurodivergent partner and you are not self-aware and don't necessarily know what you want, or you haven't had a lot of experience dating, mm-hmm. or, you know, with sex or any kind of physical intimacy, this can be really anxiety producing and create a lot of emotional challenges when you really want to explore a relationship, or you're in the process of, you know, getting serious with somebody or thinking about getting married, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it so often makes people feel like they're the odd man out if they don't participate in this, you know, because the hookup culture is pretty much you meet someone on an app, which is not conducive to the way many people actually want to meet someone. But nowadays, it seems like there's not too many other avenues to do that, right? And then, like I said, you go out and then it's an expectation to have sex. Whereas a lot of people may want to certainly build on the relationship or friendship before you get to that stage. And then that also, like I said, then you're expected to perform.
Right. And that can be very, very difficult. And so I'd like to talk a little bit about the sensory sensitivities mm-hmm. that an autistic or neurodivergent partner may not even be aware that they have related to sex and physical intimacy. And I hear this all the time. You know, some folks don't like kissing. They don't. Or they don't like French kissing, or they don't like kissing more than, you know, once, or they don't like certain physical touch.
Exactly. So or like touches on certain areas of the body, or being held in a certain way, or just being very close to someone for a prolonged period of time.
Yes, in certain sense, right?
Yes.
So what are maybe some of the top challenges that couples will come to you with related to sex and physical intimacy? Are there a few top ones that you can talk to and talk about?
Well, certainly, you know, a lot of it goes back to their style, right? What does one feel comfortable with and what the other doesn't? So if we have someone that loves to be touched and the other person not so much, right? Mm-hmm. What do you do in that situation? And in particular, at the beginning of a relationship, right?
What do you do?
Exactly. So if you don't convey that in a certain capacity, the person that likes to be touched is trying to touch you and you don't like it. Well, they're going to think like, whoa, this person's not into me. Right? And of course, there's the whole ideas of like boundaries and consent that plays into this. Right. So, you know, there's also like desire discrepancy. That's a huge thing amongst couples, in particular, neurodivergent couples. Different types of intimate things that may turn one person on versus the other. Different types of kinks, if you will. Lighting, scents, just the general ambiance to be in the mood to start with can be very different for either one of them. And again, these lead to uncomfortable conversations because we have to be vulnerable, right? And it's very difficult to be vulnerable in a hookup culture.
Yes. Yes. And I think it's very difficult to be vulnerable when you're following a script. And
exactly.
I've seen this over and over again with the men I've gone out with. Mm-hmm. Some of them seem to be using, you know, terms and words from romance rom-coms that I've seen, you know, or I feel like they're trying too hard to be something that isn't coming natural to them. And I always try so hard to give everybody grace and space to, like, you know, be their authentic self. But sometimes it's hard to watch people trying so hard. So, you know, I don't know if there are any, you know, words of advice that you have or that you share with folks that are trying to date and be both their authentic selves, but also be able to go on more than just a lot of first dates, you know?
Right. Well, First of all, I would highly recommend that you be attuned to what makes you comfortable and uncomfortable, right? Mm. And if there's something that makes you very uncomfortable, you absolutely should not do it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. That I have to put out there. That's very important.
Absolutely.
Because first of all, we have to respect ourselves. Then there's the concept of, what I said, like boundaries, right? So we have to be aware of not only our own boundaries, but other people's boundaries. And sometimes there's overlaps in that in intimate relationships, which can cause problems, right? Yeah. And the whole concept of consent. We have to make sure that, if we're going to share our body with someone, we need to make sure that we feel comfortable communicating with that person. And it's shocking how many people don't, right? So if we're not going to be able to communicate with that person and we feel uncomfortable doing certain, being involved in certain intimate acts, or not only just acts, but like physical touch, we said, or different types of kissing or pressure or whatever, then it's not going to be an enjoyable experience.
I agree. And it's funny, I'm comfortable talking about just about everything. And a few of the men that I've gone out with, one of the conversations that we've had is about, and we can do it over text, which is so wonderful, on the dating app. And I will tell folks out there, there are a lot of fake profiles on dating apps. So one of the things that I've made my practice is that I'll talk and text with somebody for, a day or two and not share a lot of intimate information. And then I ask them to do a Zoom call, or on some of the apps, you have a video chat.
Absolutely.
So I know that they are who they are. So.
Right. And that the picture that they posted is actually them.
Yes, exactly. Because there's lots of fake profiles out there. But one of the things that I found is really helpful is having those conversations by text. So, do you like kissing? What kind of kissing do you like? Do you like handholding? Do you like hugging? Or asking, what do you like? What are the top three things that turn you on? And I'll tell you, those conversations have been really wonderful, Lita, over text. And then when we do meet up, I know whether I can hug this man or not. I know whether a kiss at the end of the date is something that they're comfortable with. And I wish that, those kind of conversations had been normalized way back when I was first dating. But I think that is a plus about today's culture, if people are willing to have those conversations. What do you think?
I'm in agreement with you. And, I work with a lot of single folks where they literally show me the text that they receive or text that they want to send to make sure that it is okay. And it conveys whatever information it is they're trying to give to the other party, because you are right. Sometimes it's much more easier to communicate in text versus in person. So by doing that work in advance prior to meeting them, you kind of set the stage and you kind of know what some of the expectations are, which help to ease some of the anxiety that just comes along with dating.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. And, the other thing I want to say, you talked about consent. I think that's an issue, whether you're in the dating stages or even if you're, about to get married.
Absolutely. In any stage.
Yeah. And there's a thing out there, people will ask for naked pictures or they'll send naked pictures. Mm-hmm. And please don't do that without the consent, right? And that's of your partner too, your long-term partner. You have to be respectful of what people are asking you not to do, as well as what they're asking you to do.
Exactly. So you can see there's so many moving parts.
Yes.
that can totally lead to sensory overload in dating, in intimacy, and in moving forward with any type of premarital or wedding planning type activities.
Yes. And I love, Lita, what you said, starting with maybe one or two things that you want to talk about in all the areas that we've talked about, whether it's, your social battery, how you process things, sensory sensitivities, what you want at the wedding, your emotional needs, whatever it is, not to overload your partner, whether you're the non-autistic or the autistic partner, not to overload each other with a lot of information at once, and starting with one or two things and then addressing others as you move forward. So we're at the end of this really wonderful conversation, and I know we could probably talk about a whole lot of other things, but I'd love if there's something else that we haven't talked about that you'd like to wrap up with, you know, words of wisdom, advice for folks out there. I'd love if you would end with something we haven't addressed that you would like to share.
I think I would just like to put out there that, you know, relationships can be very beautiful, okay? But we do need to put work into it. And many people just don't realize that. And I think we need to be very respectful of one another. I think that's something that's lacking nowadays in relationships, regardless, again, of whether the individual is neurodivergent or not. But by communicating, again, in the safe space, it can just prevent so many problems. And we really need to concentrate on first ourselves and being friends with the other person before we can really take it to the next level. And I have worked with many neurodiverse, neurotypical couples that have just, you know, they were really almost ready to split, let's say, you know, but through a lot of work, they realized that they can really do it together. You know, I mean, it is possible, but you have to be able to communicate. You have to be able to work on yourself. You have to be able to have the emotional bandwidth and flexibility. And if these are not discussed and communicated, again, problems will persist, which is why I decided to begin to work with couples and individuals on the front end of relationships versus, not only versus, because I still work with couples after they get married, but to concentrate more on the before aspect of it.
Yeah. Absolutely. And Lita, I think that's a great way to end. And I always tell folks, you know, I could be the poster child for somebody that had a 30-year marriage where, you know, on the day of our divorce, we still loved each other.
Exactly.
That never changed. We always loved each other. But I think we did lose respect for each other. And I think we did lose compassion for each other. And I think our friendship our relationship became toxic, and our friendship, which was there in the beginning, I'm not sure that it really existed towards the end. So it takes concerted effort on both parties' part. And if you don't have the bandwidth to do the work, please be honest with your partner, because, you know, it's a lot of money to go to therapy or coaching, and it's a lot of emotional investment. And if you really aren't committed and your partner's holding out hope, that can be really, really, really challenging, really challenging. So I think that honesty is really, really important. So I know there's going to be a lot of people, Lita, who want to reach out to you, because this has been a wonderful conversation. And I know, you know, you do therapy in 7 states, which is wonderful, and you do coaching. So what is the best place for people to contact you?
Probably the best place, it would be via my website, which is Crystal with a C, crystalcounselingandcoaching.com. Or my phone number is 571-315-6471. And people can either call and leave a message or also text. Those would be the two best ways to reach out to me.
Wonderful. And I'll put that in the show notes. And thank you for all the work that you are doing with folks, whether it's coaching throughout the world or therapy in the 7 states you're licensed. And I think more people need to be doing this premarital counseling and coaching, because I know it happens in a lot of churches and possibly in synagogues too. But I almost think that, you know, we have to have a driver's license to drive, right?
Right.
I almost think, you know, it should be mandatory that we have premarital counseling or coaching to really understand each other before we get married or move in with each other. It would save so many folks from lots of hurt and unintentional pain, right?
Yeah. And, you know, what better way to start your life with your partner more on a solid and firm foundation than watch it crumble later?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And understanding each other's differences can be a game changer, not only for you as a couple, but your families and your children and everybody else you're involved with. So, Lita, thank you so much for taking time to be on the podcast. And thank you so much for the amazing work that you do. It has been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you so much, Mona, for your time. I greatly enjoyed this.